lines of communication established through prohibition would be used later for drugs. At this era, it's not a big thing yet. They dabble in it. Some of our characters who were attached to the family were arrested for narcotics. There weren't big sentences.
My name is Bulldog, but you may remember me as John Drummond, okay? And you're listening to Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, hello, all you wiretappers out there. Welcome to the Classic Old Ice House in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, tonight we have a special show for you. We have my good friend, former FBI agent Bill Owsley here with us. How you doing tonight, Bill?
Very good. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you back. I worked in my career, later in my career, a lot of narcotics. Actually, the FBI One Squad started working narcotics after you left, and we worked with them. And you know, I worked the L.A. Boys Task Force, the Jamaican Task Force, the OSADEP, the High Intensity Drug Task Force, and well, I don't know how many task force we had in this. Ronnie Reagan, I think, started calling it the War on Drugs, or Nixon. No, it was Nixon, wasn't it?
When Nixon.
Nixon started calling it the War on Drugs. And we act like this is some kind of a modern phenomenon that just dropped here in the 1970s, and it'd been going a long time. And folks, that's what we're going to tell you about tonight is Bill's done a lot of research, and particularly Bill has two books out there. One's Mobsters in Our Midst. I've noticed on Facebook that most everybody that posts pictures of their mob book library will hold a copy of Mobsters in Our Midst, which Bill wrote about, basically about his career fighting the mob from, what, Bill, the 1957, 58?
Until
you retired?
It was, I got 65, I think, or 4, I arrived here, retired in 85, so yeah. That whole period.
Now, a lot of people don't have this book, Open City, and this is the first book that Bill wrote, Open City, a True Story of the Kansas City Crime Family, 1900 to 1950. And in that book contains a section called the Kansas City Narcotics Syndicate. A lot of people like to believe the myth that, oh, the mob doesn't touch drugs. It's too dirty for them. They don't touch drugs. Or they're afraid of losing some of their political contacts if they get caught messing with drugs, or the sentences are so draconian that everybody will turn into a rat. But that's not particularly true. They have they're basically the ones that started the narcotics business on a large organized basis in the United States. If you'll find that out from reading Bill's book, so I'd recommend you get that. That's Open City, True Story of the Kansas City Crime Family, 1900 to 1950. It's on Amazon, and I'll put up links to both of these books on this on the show notes here. But Bill takes this back. He goes back and looks at the earliest history of the war on drugs. Bill, you talked about it being a story within a story, and so let's go all the way back. You know, like I said, we think narcotics is some kind of a modern, the opioid crisis. You know, we had crack babies, we've had the meth crisis, the opioid crisis. I don't know what'll be next. You know, the smoking banana peel crisis or something. It's just always one crisis after another.
It's those Tide Pods.
Tide Pod, yeah, the Tide Pod crisis. All the kids are eating Tide Pods and. I don't know. It's just one thing after another. I think it's all the same thing. But let's talk a little bit about what you learned in your research on how this really got started.
Yeah. Before I do that, I wanted to mention that what interested me was not only the beginnings of so many of these Cosa Nostra families and how they started, And that's what I covered in Open City, the history of the beginnings of the Kansas City family. But as I went through that, what was very interesting to me on a sociological basis was how the mob continually followed and prospered as regulation came in. The greatest of those examples, Prohibition. They regulated liquor. Thousands and millions wanted liquor. Somebody had to provide it. And the mob was there or was created during that period. I could go through sports, horse racing, boxing, and all sorts of areas that the government or the state decided to come in and regulate that particular activity. And then somebody had to fulfill the black market need because the customers don't just quit. So anyway, the one of the stories within the story is how this happened with the narcotics situation. Maybe it wouldn't have been as big as it became if there had been more thought behind legislation, more enforcement, more dedication to eradicating the problem rather than just at the time suppressing it. We're talking now about the Midwest and Kansas City. This has been duplicated in other areas. But keep in mind that my focus is on what happened in our area. Again, it's mirrored around the country. But in the 1800s, there was drug use in the 1800s. It was recreational. It was doctors prescribing these elixirs and opium-based medicines to relieve people's problems. They were even treating addicts by just keeping them in supply. There was no regulation at that time, no government regulation. Most states didn't bother with it. And at that time, they sort of blamed the problem as it developed on the Chinese. Most of the opium coming in was coming in from China. The Chinese had the opium smoking dens and what have you. And it was a major situation at that time. As with all of these vices, the time came when the public became concerned, just like they were concerned with liquor that led to the prohibition. Uncle Charlie was getting drunk. He was spending the money at the bar. This happened with the drug use, which was unregulated. The social workers and activists in the community started to raise the issue, and that led to the first regulation by the government of any substance, the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1908. Regulation began then, in a sense. Soon, states started jumping in with laws and regulations and what have you. What we need to also focus on, because of how this developed, is who were the pool of drug users at that time? They were the street people, thieves, pimps, whores, the police characters. This was not your corporate board. This was not cocaine up on Madison Avenue. And many, many women were addicted. There was a product called laudanum, which was an elixir, and it had opium in it. They took it for various reasons, and if they couldn't get it, their doctor would prescribe it for them. In fact, the doctors were continued to be an enormous supply of opium at that time. You have to consider the character of the pool of users that was available. It wasn't a big deal. With regulation, as it always happens, the criminal element starts to come in because as you suppress one thing, that need has to be fulfilled. And when it's things like alcohol or drugs or betting, sports betting, or wanting to go to the prize fights, and it's illegal, they'll make it legal.
I mean, you're talking about the 1800s My Doll, pretty much here.
Yeah, really. The 1800s My Doll, yeah, for women with menstrual cramps.
Mm-hmm. You would think the first clue that there's a problem is they're coming in more often than once every 28 days.
Really, yeah, and they did a little dose in between. But now, like, I always think of these early days of narcotics and why it even started regulating it as a crime rather than some kind of a medical problem, because that's kind of the deal today. You know, wait a minute, we're not doing so well regulating this as a crime. Maybe we should look at this as a medical problem. Part of because what you said about it was criminals who already were wanting to take drugs and get high and maybe use that as a substitute for alcohol. Either one will make you high, and only one of them, it smells on your breath and you start stumbling around a lot worse than maybe if you're taking some kind of opium or you're smoking opium. No, I think you just get sleepy, but I don't know. I don't have any experience. What about you, Aaron?
I don't know. I watched the movie Ray, you know, and he was a heroin addict.
Yeah.
That seems a little bit more involved, though, than if you're, you know.
And I've known a couple of heroin addicts. It seemed like they just nod out. But anyhow, be that as it may, I just wonder why. Was that like the only way they had to look at it as a law enforcement criminal issue rather than, well, these women, they seem to be needing this stuff more and more. That seems to be a problem. You know, shouldn't we do something medically?
I can't address all of the reasonings that went behind it. I think it's inherent in how the government approaches things. They're looking at taxing this product as a way of regulating it rather than enforcing it or, as you say, going at it from a different direction. It was pretty much the same with alcohol. Why not treat the drunks? No, they banned alcohol. So the government sort of doesn't look from that standpoint. In fact, there was a huge argument when the next major legislation came in, the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1914, there was a huge to-do about, well, are you people just looking to make money? You don't care about this thing. You're going about it as taxation. And they said, well, no, we're not. You know, we're going to ban something and lose revenue if you're talking about taxation. But you can see there was this dichotomy in people feeling how it was being approached. But all I can say to it is from what I see in history, how the government approaches these type of things, vice kinds of activity, gambling, drinking, boxing, horse racing, all at one time, all they tried to do is regulate it. They never looked at any other alternatives. And usually they never had sufficient enforcement to go with it. And that's what caused a lot of the problem.
I think probably, Bill, more than likely, it's because a lot of people that are attracted to that may be kind of in the gray areas of life anyhow, that are attracted to heavy drinking, to bars, to horse race, or to gambling and prostitution and things like that. And plus, there's, of course, prostitution. There are certain biblical prohibitions of things like that. But and probably narcotics use. I think of the early, in the 30s, narcotics use, you always thought of the jazz musicians and people that lived in that kind of netherworld, if you will, kind of exist in that, not in the Square John world and not in the total criminal world, but kind of in between in those kinds of worlds. Maybe that may be some reason why they looked at it more as let's make this into more of a crime and more of a crime, and that's a way to control it.
Well, I think you have a good point there because, as I said, this pool was not a huge pool. I mean, there were a lot of narcotics users, but as I say, it wasn't the social problem that it became. The middle class, the high class, the wealthy, the entertainment field, where, you know, drugs became as common as a Coors Light beer. At that time, they may have thought, this is restricted to a certain element, and if we can get the doctors out of this, we can handle a lot of it. And at first, the doctors didn't comply, but then they started cracking down on them. And, of course, that shorted the supply also. So gradually we're leading to a black market. And I won't jump ahead of myself, but we'll get to the point where these entities that developed are going to take a rather modest need, and they're going to grow it into something that we see in the last 50 years or so.
There's a shortage out there of this product, and there seems to be getting more and more demand. And to find more of this product, which would be an opiate at that point in time, I'm not sure where marijuana figures into this. It may or may not.
It comes later. It
comes later. And so it's an opiate, and we don't really seem to grow opium poppies. That's where they come from in the United States. So that's when they start reaching out overseas. And that's when and this is a point in time when the Black Hand is setting up in your various eastern to middle west cities, which were criminal organizations with ties directly back to the Mediterranean area. And best I can tell, I know they grow a lot of poppies in Turkey and around in the Middle East. So, and they have these natural old ties, trade routes, if you will, from Sicily back into Turkey and Lebanon and around the Middle East. Is that kind of how it, you know, is that, would that be the genesis then of the organization of this, you know, this product and getting, make, creating a supply and bringing the supply in and then finding the customers?
As this situation we talked about, we're talking about the turn of the century, early 1900s. The Cosa Nostra doesn't exist. The Black Hand is really not coordinated or organized. They're establishing themselves, trying to get a foothold, but they're pretty much relegated to the Little Italys of the city. They can get drugs from their friends who in Italy and all that. They are not of the ilk yet to establish really big labs over there and transporting it. And this is still the embryo stage. Now, they're supplying a little bit of drugs to this small pool of ne'er-do-wells. It isn't even a big population of users yet. And then, before they can really maybe organize, if they're thinking about drugs, prohibition comes along. Well, now they're diverted in their interest to something way bigger than narcotics. Your pool of people who want to drink and all of the sidelights that go with alcohol was enormous. It was an enormous potential. And the mob, pretty much around the country, focused their attention on prohibition. So in this early stage, historically, the Jews in New York and other places, some of the other ethnic groups that were, they did most of the narcotics. The Italian Sicilian faction wasn't fully developed yet. Our family didn't develop until prohibition, when all of the Black Hand groups came together. And they're pretty well focused on liquor. And it's huge. It's huge. In fact, the international lines of communication established through prohibition would be used later for drugs. So at this era, it's not a big thing yet. They dabble in it. Some of our characters who were attached to the family were arrested for narcotics. There weren't big sentences. Most of them did maybe a year, if anything. And so there wasn't any suppression of it, really. So in this early era, the narcotics trade, at least in this part of the world here and in many other areas, was relegated to, as I say, the Jewish criminal organizations, Irish criminal organizations, and the Italians would come in later.
So this is, you know, we're going 1933, 34 is kind of the prohibition is winding down. When did it end? I can't remember.
1933, let's see, it went from 20 to 33,
33, okay, that's what I thought. So, you know, it's winding down. That's got to be a huge loss of money. Because, I mean, they could turn their speakeasies into legitimate clubs, I understand that. But you can't make near as much money off of a barrel of beer or a carton, a case of whiskey as you could before. So that's, and I always thought of them moving more into gambling at that time, maybe even some little bit of the or continuing with some organized prostitution because it was more susceptible. Prostitution is not susceptible to organization today, but back then it was more susceptible to organization. And I always thought of that, but they moved into narcotics and particularly on what would be an example of how that would work here in Kansas City, because it would be representative in Kansas City of as in every other Chicago and New York and probably Tampa and all the New Orleans, all the cities that had a major family would have worked the same way.
Well, yeah, because when the drug business was put on a corporate level where they were going to not only deal with this small pool, but they were going to expand it, you know, just as they did in Prohibition. If there were 12 bars on a main street, they put in 40. When they get into something, it isn't just to supply some demand, take over where someone else left off. There, the Cosa Nostra is like Walmart. They are going to promote their products. As you said, gambling was one of the things that they saw on the horizon. They knew the wind was, it was in the wind that Prohibition was going to be ending. It had done its deal. The people didn't want it anymore. So they were aware of this. In fact, they were supposed to have had a major meeting in Atlantic City in the 30s to determine where are we going to go from here. Gambling was one of the areas they said, okay. And then we saw the plush clubs, the carpet joints, the bookie operations, the racetracks that they got into. They went in full blast. But there's always enough people to go into other directions. And one of the other directions they saw as a moneymaker and has had great potential was the narcotics industry. And let me back up just a minute here before we get into that era. One of the main historical events of that era was in 1930. They established the Bureau of Narcotics. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics was established, and it was to enforce the Harrison Act from 1914. As I say, it had not been enforced to any great degree. That was typical of the government. They didn't correlate law with enforcement. The regulation created a black market. The drug situation wasn't changing that much, but it was still small relatively to Prohibition. The narcotics agents, prior to that, the Harrison Act was updated, and they banned all importation of heroin. No use at all, no medical use. It just, you couldn't bring it in, but it was coming in. So Henry Anslinger, the first director, he dispatched his people to Europe to find the sources of this drug and how it was getting here. And what's important about that is their early investigations abroad provided the intelligence of this blossoming criminal organization that would later become Cosa Nostra. They were the first and only bureau in the federal government to cry out that this syndicate exists here. Okay, by 1932, Cosa Nostra had consolidated. So we had that situation of at least one federal agency was seeing the writing on the wall. Nobody followed suit.
By that point in time in history, this white powder substance, or maybe some kind of a liquid that with this substance known as heroin mixed in with it, that would take away your pain, if it will, and or I don't think they had it in pill form. And so they figured out this was called heroin. It was an opiate paste, I believe, or it could be morphine for use in a medical facility. But when it get to the street, it was labeled heroin. I'm always curious about how they decide, you know, that, well, okay, this is legal, illegal, just to have it in your possession. And so they figured that out and I guess did some kind of probably analysis of it. So when they found it and then they analyzed this substance, they say, this is heroin, so this is illegal in itself. Is that kind of how it worked? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I can't address how they came up with the formulas that made this heroin and that opiate-based something else. But one of the things that happened, Anslinger, when he took over, he was a very, very forceful director. He took this seriously. They were the first to start using, on a broad scale against the narcotics organization, informants, undercover people, all of that kind of stuff, which was not very well used in that era. But he was the one who said, anyone that has heroin, you know, is guilty. So I think that's where we came to the user being included. He wanted it that strong, you know. And he was also the one who lobbied and resulted in the first Marijuana Act, which was like 1938 or so. And because he saw all drugs as evil and had to be addressed. The protocol of what's heroin, what's this, how they do it, pretty much was something I don't know how exactly they labelized all these drugs, but they didn't want any of them.
It's probably as Harry Anslinger decided this is heroin, yeah, and this is, yeah, marijuana, yeah, and this is illegal. And
there were practical uses for these and medical uses for, the morphine, if you will. Just how would they regulate it that way? In terms of they still wanted to be able to have access to the resources of the drug, but just from a controlled standpoint.
Well, they had been exempting many of the medical facilities, even some of the major producers that supplied the hospital. They had made exceptions for some of these people. In fact, they made the exception for the doctors back then, but they had restricted them. And of course, where there's money to be involved, the doctors continued to put out prescriptions like we have today. You know, it was similar to the opioid situation today where, pharmacies are in a town of 200 are filling 6,000 prescriptions for an opiate. The major drug people today are sending 100,000 units to a city of 10,000, and they say, well, we don't know anything about it. It was the same thing here. The doctors, don't you do that? Well, of course, so-and-so gets a prescription. Well, finally, they really started monitoring them, with the drug people. They came in and they had to have records and what have you, and they sent doctors to jail. And that's the best deterrent for a doctor.
Yeah.
So, but there have been exemptions to handle legitimate use.
I guess it's a little bit like during Prohibition, you could go to a doctor or a pharmacist and get medical whiskey. You can get a bottle of whiskey that was prescribed for you.
I thought all whiskey was medical.
Yeah, well, they could
use... if it's only a teaspoonful with some lemon and honey.
they allowed alcohol in, like, beauty products and all that. One of our mob guys had taken over a barber shop and started dealing alcohol in a bottle on the shelf. It said gel cream, and it was booze.
Yeah.
So eventually they had to, get off after those people. It's a connect the dots kind of thing. We do this, they do that. We have to approach that, and then they do this. And so many times that could have been prevented if the ramifications and fallout of my legislation, when I propose this, the fallout should be considered. During our time, Gary, you may remember, but Kansas promoted a bingo law.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And it had to go through a VFW or that type of club. They had to apply for the license. Well, there was no regulation to go with it. They had maybe one guy for the entire state or something. So the mob went in and created a group that was, I can't think of the word now.
It was like a straw group. It was like a nonprofit straw group.
I remember when they did that and then
set up a bingo game.
Yeah.
And you looked at the board of directors of that nonprofit that was supposed to be taking that money and doing some kind of good with it. And it was all these different mob wives and in-laws and stuff like that. So
you know, this has been a historical problem with legislation. Maybe sometimes there's nothing you could do, but I think a good example for our community here is when Missouri legalized the casinos.
Yeah.
They used all of the intelligence and information and documentation from the Vegas cases that were broken, from the intelligence from they hired the right commission. My former boss, Bill Quinn, was put on the commission, and I knew he'd be honest to the day as long, and they have not had a big problem.
No, not at all.
So they did the right thing. Legislation combined with a consideration of the fallout and the unintended consequences.
And you realize that when there's a lot of money to be made, that you need to really vet the people who are in control of these things. And they didn't really do that very well in the 30s. The politicians were a little bit shady already, and so they just did not do that at all in the
30s. I mean, if you're a manufacturer of any of these for medical purposes, it'd probably be pretty easy to, you know, you do a run, if you will, you know, a manufacturing run, and you always maybe have a variance.
Yeah,
but it just always happens to be, you know, more than you tell people. It just seems really easy. I mean, wasn't there a level of obviously the legislation not stopping the problem? An attempt to address it and kind of put a framework to address it and attack it. But what about, because this stuff was coming from a long ways away. What about interdiction?
That's what Dan Slinger and the Bureau of Narcotics said about doing. They were going to try to cut off the trade routes to find out where it was going, how it was going, who was involved. Of course, by this time, as they get into the 40s, they're starting to put together the French Connection, how the labs were in Marseille. They were hiding the drugs in various packages or whatever, cars and boxes and pottery and whatever you could think of. And then later the Sicilian Mafia, as they increased, they had their labs, they had their trade routes. So that's what they were trying to develop, the legitimate people who to get their drugs. Would have to go through a more legitimate process. These would have to be vetted places that are not labs in some basement. These were accepted and regulated providers of opium. So there had to be some of those. If you have an exception, and we don't grow poppies here, or make heroin, although I guess you could. I don't know that about it. There was a process for that. The problem was, as the drug addiction and the drug organizations grew, that became the problem, not some guy trying to give a prescription for laudanum. And so the real problem that the Federal Narcotics Bureau had to address was the huge amounts coming into very large, sophisticated criminal organizations.
Now, probably started out just like it still has developed today in South America. You have in a really poor community in Turkey. You've got these little farmers out raising these poppy fields, and there a lot of them are being sold to the legitimate people, but they probably found out they could make a little extra money on the side, and you're going to have criminal organizations all around the Mediterranean anyhow. And so they, you know, organize some of these farmers and create poppy fields that aren't on the books, shall we say, and then they figure out these other lines of transport, you know, on end to where you can get it refined, and then on where there's a market over in the United States, and it's exactly what's happened in Colombia and Peru and Mexico and all over the Western Hemisphere, and I guess it really started back then, it appears to me like.
Well, you have that's a good point to bring up. First of all, you're talking about foreign entities. You know, Turkey wherever those countries are that have huge poppy industry, that's big money for not only the government, but that's their, like you say, that's their livelihood. The government isn't going to suppress the poppy growers. Our State Department, they're caught between the rock and the hard place. I mean, they want to go to Turkey and say, we're going to cut off all your money if one poppy seeds or any of this gets into our country. They're not going to do that, you know, because political, we need their support, we need to put a missile base there, whatever it is. So these people have a free hand in growing poppies. Not much you can do about that. Once the syndicate says, we are going to put heroin on a major basis, then they go and make the contacts. They make contacts with that guy in Colombia, this farmer out here. They make a contract. We'll take all of the poppy that you can grow, and we're going to give you more than you're going to get. And then they create the illegal labs. The poppy seeds are transported to Sicily, to the French people, or whoever is establishing these illicit processing plants. The heroin is then produced there. So it's very difficult to suppress something like heroin from its origin in the poppy fields.
And it sounds like this really started back in, you know, the early 1900s and just has grown and developed a little bit more. The more there is a demand, the more, you know, their supply is going to continue to grow, because those Turkish poppy farmers aren't going to grow a bunch of poppies that they don't have someplace to sell. And so it's just slowly but surely grown over the years.
It goes back to what I mentioned is once the decision was made, that drugs will be our major, one of the major things, we are going to expand to make money. Okay, once, and of course being that the Italian-Sicilian people, mobs, had open connections to the old country, that helped. But once they decided drugs is going to be on our agenda, then the rest of the system started to come to play. They sent their people over. They made contacts. They made contacts with the people who could get the poppies, or they went and did it themselves. But generally, they relied on their compadres, other illicit drug operations, whether they be French or Turkish or what. The connections were made, and the lines were open. And that increased the whole system. It goes back to what I said earlier. When the mob gets into something, it isn't just to take care of a few people or to pick up where somebody may have left off. Their idea is to expand it into a business where we're going to make new customers. We're going to promote this And what they did in the big cities, the mob guys went into the ethnic neighborhoods, the black neighborhoods, the Hispanic neighborhoods, whatever, or any neighborhoods, the poor neighborhood, and they were like hawking drugs. They made it cheap to begin with. They hooked people, you know, but they promoted this. The entire system grew as the mob, mainly the Cosa Nostra, as they outlived all the other organizations. But as they grew and promoted this operation, that whole system of growing, transporting, laboratories, importation, that became a corporate entity. They had, you know, salesmen. They had whatever you need. And we'll see that in a minute if we get to the Kansas City Syndicate.
Yeah, that's a good place to stop. We're going to cut this up into two episodes, folks. It's it's a lot of information to digest at one time, and so we will make a public service announcement, and I want you to we'll put this episode up pretty soon, and then we'll put a week after that we'll put up the second episode, and Bill will get a lot more specific about the actual people, and we'll use Kansas City as a typical example of how they did their drug dealing and who did it and what were the lines. I believe Kansas City even reached down into Cuba at that time, had really strong connections down into Cuba and Tampa.
That's right. That's right.
Cool. I didn't really know that before I read your book. This is kind of apropos for this show. If you have a friend or relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase on Amazon. And then what you want to do is get the app, Kansas City Mob Tour. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And if that's not enough, because you're really a mob fan, you want to get Mobsters in Our Midst by our guest Bill Owsley, as well as Open City, the book that we're really talking about in this episode of Gangland Wire, and then get Gary's book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos. And I'll have links to all three of these books up on my show notes.
And you want to get the Kindle version of Leaving Vegas, because embedded in that Kindle version is the audio transcription. You can hear the words from the mouth of the men that did it.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Bill.
Goodnight.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
With the end of Prohibition, they needed a new field.
Yeah.
Narcotics was now starting to become a big deal. You know, it was not just the Chinese and the opium dens.
So during Prohibition, mob didn't really pay much attention to it. They kind of kept their fingers in a little bit.
Yeah, because Cork got arrested and this guy got arrested. And there were guys dabbling in it, but it wasn't the moneymaker that it became. Until the mob gets into it, then they get in. And that's what the story is here. One of the earliest of these groups to put narcotics on a major business basis was the Narcotics Syndicate here.
The Kansas City Narcotics Syndicate.
And the story of how they put it together in 1930, finally, they came to the conclusion the laws were good, but they needed to be enforced.
Yeah.
And in 1930, the Bureau of Narcotics was established. Anslinger came in. He was a tough guy.
He was the original...
Original director.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I thought he was a little later.
No, he's the original director.
Well, he lasted a long time.
He did.
He lasted clear up the 50s, didn't he?
I think. I don't know. Harry Giordano or something was the next guy.
Okay.
But this blossomed under Anslinger.
Yeah,
and what they were doing in the initial stages was to attack the importation. So most of their agents were abroad, Turkey, Italy, France, wherever the poppy seed was, and they were trying to trace the lines of importation. And they had agreements where they could buy bus and all that with the locals. And as they busted, they were getting intelligence. Bottom line, they were the first to say, there's a freaking mafia here.
Yeah.
This is an organization. These Italian groups all connect. Nobody listened to them. Yeah. Nobody listened to them. Huh. But anyway, okay. So it's a story within the story, which is sort of interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's a fascinating story. I didn't think about it until Seth got, I don't know, he and that other guy up there in Detroit. Somehow they had the idea to look at the old narcotic syndicate. I mean, there's stuff out there about it, and they must have found your book or something, because Seth just called me out of nowhere, and he said, I'd like to get connected with Bill Owsley to talk to him about the narcotic syndicate.
Well, I think, you know, Seth has been, it seems to me, his main focus has been drug people, his books, and all of that. And I would imagine, probably in doing research and all, maybe he came to the conclusion that one of the stories is before the big the cocaine cartel and the Cali cartel and the pizza connection. Before that, what happened? How did this all? I'm guessing.
I think
because that seems to be what he's going to focus on.
It looks like it to me. The little trailer I sent.
Yeah, because if he came and interviewed me, I said, I don't know anything about drugs after 1940.
Yeah, no, he told me it's that's what it's about, is those early days. How the whole war on drugs, if you will, got started and who was involved.
The war on drugs didn't come till 70 under Nixon.
Yeah.
When they gave it that name.
They gave it that name, but there'd been
It had been growing ever since. Yeah. And whatever they do, they put it on a business basis.
Yeah.
And so what happens also, okay, when you, if I have 100 people who like candy bars, and I'm supplying 100 people, then Walmart comes in, and we got a lot of candy, and we need to sell it to a lot of people. So my runners go out, so now drugs is way beyond this little pool, because they're a corporate entity.
They cut prices, they package it a little better.
Everything, salesmen,
crack
representatives.
Cocaine,
They open up a pharmacy.
So once they get in it, they don't get in it to take care of a few people. How do we make a ton of money on this?
Interesting. Yeah, the story.
Why don't you sit up to the mic here? Because I've just been rolling tape here. I don't know if you're on. If you're Zoom
levels.
Recorders.
Yeah,
recording.
I'm rolling. Okay, mine looks pretty good.
2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. How's it looking?
Keep talking.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. We're going to talk about drugs. Oh, Seth has got a new documentary he's working on where he sent me a little clip where he's
who is
Seth?
Ronnie's
got a new one. He's kind of been working on it. off and on.
Way up. You're kind of tipping to the side, maybe. You got to
where he's been working off and on for the last couple 3 years. Where he started out, he was just going to go out and walk in the bad neighborhoods of St. Louis at night with a camera and another guy, and just document that. And he kind of started doing that. And then as part of that, it didn't really go anywhere. And he probably got scared off. Actually, I didn't ask him, but but he found some kind of a street preacher there in St. Louis. He's a real interesting guy. So he started following him around and documenting what he did with people on the streets. And he's trying to put that together in one of these kind of, not a historical documentary like we're talking about here, but something that's happening, basically now on
like
the streets of St. Louis.
Like a Vice News story.
Like a Vice News story, yeah.
Yeah.
So
well,
he's an interesting guy.
Yeah, he is. He is. And I guess he's got a lot of things going on all the time.
He does.
I got a... there are two big entities going to be doing a big documentary on Vegas.
Oh, really? I hadn't heard that. You know, they're doing one on Gotti. We interviewed a lady who wrote a book, and they're doing one on Gotti and A&E on
Gotti and Sons.
Gotti and Sons, and Gotti Jr. is helping and participating. You know, yeah. He and another guy have started a website called WITSEC. And they're going to look at trying to find people with stories about being in a witness protection program and what it was like for them. So there's a lot of stuff going on in this mob thing. I didn't know who's doing it on Las Vegas.
Well, as a producer in Hollywood and a London-based documentary group. So I don't know.
Maybe would it be the same ones that were doing the Richard Attenborough Presents?
Who?
Richard Attenborough Presents.
I don't know. I don't know who the hell they are.
I'm just saying that was this maybe the people that kind of contacted Martin to do that story.
Could be. I don't know.
Well, somebody called me. An ex-agent from California, L.A. called me, and he said, "Can I give him your name?" I said, "Yeah, I'll talk to him." And the same with this other thing. I haven't heard. I mean, I haven't.
You never know. You know.
Yeah. And the one guy tried to get a hold of me, left a message, and he was going to be gone a while, and he'd get back to me, the guy from L.A.
Yeah.
And his story is that it's going to be the term they used? Not the ultimate, but this was going to be the Las Vegas thing. I felt like saying, how many the...
This year,
yeah. You know, really.
Or next year, depending on production schedule.
Well,
but it's a never-ending, never-ending deal, and it for some reason seems to be getting bigger.
It's getting bigger now. It is.
I don't know why.
It keeps expanding.
It's really Gary's fault in part.
A lot of people are getting into it too. The people that are trying to make money off of this, writing books and stuff, and. Having these Facebook pages, they're just expanding like crazy, and there's more and more people getting into it. Starting podcasts, there's been a couple of little mob podcasts start up recently, and there's one of the big boys, I don't know who it is, but they're connected with another larger company that has something to do with public radio, I think, and they've started one called Mafia.
Oh, really?
So they're doing... They're basically, it's a narrator just has done his research well about, he did his first two were on Sam Giancana, and then the next one's on Lucky Luciano, so they're doing the real popular mob characters and just tell, the history. You know, I love really about the history of them is what it is. It's a history kind of a podcast, so.
Well, if you want to jump in with something that I don't know anybody's doing, because, but you talk about a fascinating story, is the Sicilian Mafia.
Yeah, that's true. Nobody's really doing
it. No.
They pay a little bit of attention to it on some of those Facebook things. Yeah. There's people writing about it a little bit.
Yeah, but I got a lot of stuff on it because Lee Flossy, was the legat over there.
Yeah, that's right.
And when he came back, finally, besides all the stuff he put together from that, then when he came back, he had the Italian guys come over here and made a presentation to a conference we had in Chicago.
Yeah.
And they had a lot of handout material about all the intelligence they had gathered. And it's a hell of a story if you want to do it sometime. Yeah. And but I'm more fascinated with the Italian mafia.
than the American.
Because it's... They were so powerful over there.
I know.
They were the government.
They were the government, yeah.
But one guy, proverb this guy said. He said, even the stones belong to the mafia.
There's a lot of stones over there in Sicily.
Yeah.
There's a documentary film that's coming out in April here. What was that? That Wednesday. I think I forwarded you a... Maybe just you were busy.
I saw that. I couldn't.
You had to kind of zoom in on it, but it's something about Italy and Sicily and a documentary about that.
No, look, it's more like a travelogue about Sicily to me, or kind of a travel. I mean, it wasn't an organized crime thing or anything.
No, not specifically.
It was more like a kind of a travelogue of Sicily or something. Yeah. I've looked that up. I thought, you know, if I'd ever go back to Mediterranean, that place is really, it's really beautiful and inexpensive. And
well, that's what I told my wife. I had on a bucket list, I'd like to go to Corleone and just say, I was there.
I was there.
You know, and they have a museum, even, I heard.
Oh, really?
But I'd probably get kidnapped.
Really? We did a story on the Camorra Mafia
once. Oh, that's something else.
And, you know, they're talking about these little towns back up in the mountains down there in southern Italy, and they're still, like, kind of control some of those little towns down there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They are a lot different than the Sicilian mob, but it's all the same stuff.
Yeah.
They're broken up into a lot of
groups. That was the main difference. They didn't have any kind of, you know, pyramidal kind of scheme.
No,
it was
cupola,
all there and here and here and here, and then they would, these different groups might meet and kind of agree to coordinate, but they
there was no,
on a day-to-day basis, they just operated in their own little world.
That's right. And they were decentralized.
Yeah, that's a good way to, and then couldn't think of the word. All right,
Aaron. Do you want me to just cue the music here? Do you want to get a liner from Bill?
Huh?
Oh, I've got liners from him. I think I got a couple of them. So,